Are we?
We're broadcasting.
We're broadcasting now? Yes?
Yep.
Hi, everybody. This is the Apollo 13 crew of New School Creation, holding it all together with scotch tape and some other things. Our first time out. Thanks for being here, everybody. We're going to begin with introductions of those of us who are here. My name is Larry Rosenstock. I'm the CEO and one of the founders, one of the many founders of High Tech High, which is an organization of nonprofit K-12 charter schools in California, and also holder of a graduate school of education that's embedded within our schools. And we're going to next hear from Feroz Munshi.
Oh, okay. Hi, everyone. My name is Feroz Munshi. I have a lot of hats right now. I'm a doctoral student at UC Berkeley. And I work at the university with in one of the credentialing programs. And I also do a little bit of consulting work on the side around PBL, project-based learning. I think that's about it. And I come to all of this having been a high school teacher for about 10 years. I worked with Larry actually at one point, helping found one of the schools in his network, and I've also been a founder of a charter school in another network. So I've been around a lot of different kinds of schools in my career.
Okay, I can't hear for us, but okay. Next up is going to be Judith Warren Little.
Hi, everybody. This is Judith Warren Little. I'm the dean at the Graduate School of Education at UC Berkeley. Been there 27 years, but I don't just hang out in the hallways at the ivory tower. I spend a lot of time out in schools. Done a fair amount of that hanging out with Larry over the last 20 years, and I'm excited to find out what develops in this course.
Great. Thank you so much. Okay. Dan Wise.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dan Wise. I work currently at Tufts University's Center for Engineering Education and Outreach. So we're a university-based center that studies what it looks like when really K-16 students do engineering, and we use that to inform our outreach programs, product design, and other things. So I work on the outreach end where I work with different schools. Before that, I was a high-tech high teacher for 4 years, and before that I was in the New York City school system. And one thing that excites me about this course is that when I was in New York, a couple friends and I were part of a new school creation team, and there were a lot of lessons learned the hard way from that, so I wish that I had been part of something like this before we started. So I've seen bits of it here and there, and I'm excited to see what comes of it.
Great. Thank you, Dan. And now we're going to hear from Sam Seidel.
Hi, everybody. As Larry said, I'm Sam Seidel. I'm an education consultant and writer and public speaker. I have a book I wrote called Hip Hop Genius, Remixing High School Education. And I've taught in a variety of settings from first grade through community college. Some of my other work focuses on youth arts, youth development, and work in prisons. And this year I'm a scholar in residence at Columbia University.
Okay, and we have Nikki Hinostro, who will be joining us when her technical problems get fixed. She is here. She is in the building. We're going to begin right now by, we know that this is sort of in your file of possible things to look at, and some of you might have looked at. We've debated quite a bit as to whether to ask you to look at it again, but it's only about 5 or 6 minutes long, and we want to see it again. It's a video called Dualities, and it was created off of first a talk, and then a PowerPoint, and now an animated video that addresses the tensions and dualities that you have to think about when starting a new school. So we want everyone to take a look at it right now so we can have the panelists and have a discussion about it. Are we going to be able to show it now, Patrick? Yes, okay.
Hi, everybody. This is Patrick. Turn your volume down, too. I'm playing the video. Let's see if it works. Is this mute?
Ready? Good. Okay, great. Okay. I think a good way of talking about creating a school is starting to think about dualities. The Zen of starting a school, so to speak. So the first duality I want to talk about is the yin and yang of not only what you put into the school, which is what much of you will be thinking about, but also what you don't allow in, what you don't let in. There's a lot of things you don't need to have in schools that people think you must. Segregated adult and children's bathrooms, for example. Public address systems, bells. You don't need to have those things. And schools have a different feel if you don't. You want to keep it simple. Complex structures beget very simple behaviors, like the military. Or simple structures get complex behaviors, as Sir Giovanni said. Or as Charlie Mingus once said, it's easy to make the simple complicated. True genius lies in making the complex simple. So keep your school simple. Don't overthink it. Don't overload it. You want a school that isn't just about student learning, but it's also about adult learning. Adult and student learning taking place in tandem. As Michelangelo said at the very end of his life, I am still learning. People have to do something to the things they want to find out about. They need to alter conditions, as John Dewey said. People need to find things through invention and reinvention. As Freire said, be thinking about that, about having a school in which kids are altering conditions and thinking about things and reinventing things, yourself included. And using technology in schools, people think about consumption of technology and they don't think about production through the use of technology. The beauty of production is that kids are inventing and making things. And the other benefit is that, of course, if they're producing, they're also consuming. If you're consuming, you're not necessarily producing. So if you're producing, you get both. If you're consuming, you don't. We want to use your head, and we want to use your hands, and you want to use both well. MIT's motto is mens et manus, head and hand. Making things, thinking about things, using head and hand. Tinkering is the great fun that a lot of us have, experimenting and taking things apart and fixing machines and the like. Tinker with your school and make a school in which adults and kids are tinkering with everything that they're doing, physically by making things and also thinking about how they're scheduling, how they're doing everything. Let people mix it up, keep mixing it up, keep it interesting. There is still a role for storytelling. I am doing it right now. Socrates did it in 400 BC with people under a tree. It's okay to tell stories sometimes. There's definitely a role for that. It's interesting when you've got a good storyteller. Don't avoid that completely. We just don't want it to be 100% of what happens in schools, which is what's typically going on. I had a guest to our schools once, and someone said to me, how is this different from most schools? And for some reason, I just said, this is different in that in most schools the students are doing the listening and the adults are doing the talking, and in our schools the adults are doing a lot of listening and the students are doing the talking. When you're doing a new school, someone once told me, someone who had a great effect on my life, Vito Perone, said to me, when you're doing a school and you're getting ready to do a school, there's two things you need to do. Of course you need to do it well, but you also need to describe it well. Doing a good school is really important, but describing it, you need to have a narrative. You need to know a way to describe that school to prospective parents, prospective students, prospective teachers, prospective funders, prospective authorizers. Very important. Prospective peers in the education community. So you need to also be uncovering material, not just covering the material, like students doing field work, getting in the muck and mire of things, getting all involved in it all. So it's not just covering the subject, it's actually revealing and uncovering the subject. There's great power also in collaborative study groups. I went to law school. I've asked quite a few people the following question. If your life depended on getting through law school and you could only do one of the following three and none of the other two, would you go to the classes, would you read the cases, or would you be in a study group? Almost everybody has said, be in a study group. Most recently, someone who's now a U.S. senator, as a matter of fact, said to me, be in a study group 10 times over. Engagement You want everybody to be engaged. You want the adults to be engaged. You want the students to be engaged. You find meaning. Meaning comes from being engaged. You want people to be perplexed, in the good sense of being perplexed. The great engineers that I know, the great educators I know, the great artists I know, they're obsessed with how to do it better. They're perplexed about what's not good enough and how to do it better. That's a good posture to take, because perplexity and the paradox of perplexity has a healing effect, in that when you get to that next level and you figure that thing out and you have that aha, you feel some satisfaction, and that inspiration has motivated you, and you've taken the invisible and you've made it visible. You've exhibited what you've come up with. Public exhibitions are absolutely critical in schools for adults, for students to publicly exhibit their work and their thinking, just like I'm doing right now. And then you go to be perplexed about the next thing that you're perplexed about. As we get to the end of this, I want to talk a little bit about stability and churning. Having been principal of a 350-year-old high school, I found that people really, really valued stability. I think stability can be overemphasized at the expense of losing churning and mixing it up. Of course, you don't want it to be unstable, but you don't want it to be stuck. There has to be a lot of oxygen. Einstein said it was easy to discover the theory of relativity. All I had to do was ignore a few basic axioms. If you're creating a new school, think about that. Ignore a few basic axioms. And remember, it's not just what you put in, it's what you let in. And remember, hard on the content, soft on the people. And remember, work hard and have fun.
Okay, we are back. I am going to ask you in turn if you would comment on each of you on something that really jumps out at you about what you've just seen. I could ask you maybe to put up your hand if you're ready to jump on that. Maybe that's a good thing, so I can see all of you rather than just randomly calling on you. Would someone like to take a shot at one of the first things that jumps out at you about those dualities? I am going to I'm going to fill the void since I don't see any hands raised. I hope you can hear me, right? What strikes me about it, because of several questions that we've gotten some people here, is what about recreating a school? Recreating a school puts you in that posture of balancing stability and churning. And I think that when you're dealing with families and teachers in an existing school, they are a little bit afraid that the school is going to become unstable if you change it a little bit. And I think it's important to speak to them about their own experiences, let's say at the high school level or whatever, and whether or not that is something that they think should be something that should be carried forward to this very day for their own children, and try to make it very personal for them, and think about how telecommunications have changed, and transportation has changed, and everything else has changed, and schools, which are very precious institutions, still essentially haven't while the world changes around them. That was the point about the balance between stability and churning. Who else would like to jump in on this?
I'll go, Larry. So this is Judith. So I'm struck by the decision point in the dualities video in relation to the reading for today, which came from Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's The Good High School. So I remember when that book came out and how liberating in a way it was in the face of people, everyone trying to decide what is the perfect good school, to appreciate the ways in which schools can be good in lots of different ways, with lots of different choices. So one of the things that strikes me about the dualities video, though, is the repeated refrain, you want. So there is a set of values that I think join the folks who have entered into designing this course. There isn't a commitment to cloning a particular design, but what I detect is a commitment to a particular set of values that we anticipate, I think, help people resolve some of the tensions or resolve some of the dualities. What do you make of that?
Okay, anybody want to pick up on that question of values? I will hearing nothing. I think that, again, when you're thinking about narrative, you don't want to have a laundry list in designing a school of like every good thing that you can think of. So one value for us, for example, from the very beginning, and I think the primary value for us at High Tech High, was social class integration, a rarity in public education today, at least in the United States. That was one. And the second one is this whole idea of production rather than mere consumption, and having kids publish books, get patents, and make and create things, because we all derive so much satisfaction from making something that wasn't there before, like creating a school. Those are the two key values that I use, and there's a lot more that I could pile on, but oftentimes people tell me, you know, describe your school in 10 words or in 15 seconds, and those are the two I use, social class integration and students producing things of meaning to them. Anybody else want to talk about these dualities?
Yeah, Nikki?
Are we on?
I hope so.
Okay. So in starting new schools, I think one of the biggest challenges is building culture from the beginning. And something that's grounded our staff is we started High Tech Middle Media Arts, and then again when we started High Tech High North County was personalization. This is one of our design principles, and when we started as a community of adults and said, our primary goal is to know our students. And this, we said, no matter what we're doing, if we fall back on, okay, are we getting to know our students better? Are we learning about who they are as human beings? Then everything else can follow from there and create a safe space for them so that they feel honored.
Yeah, to add to that, one thing that struck me was this notion of simple structures. And it was something that, honestly, when I got to High Tech High, it took me a little while to get around because I was so used to schools with a million policies. But what ended up working out well is that because there were simple structures and there were core values like integration, like, you know, authentic work, I think that it created much more personalization for the teachers, and that trickled down to the students. So I think often of schools where the teachers are doing the really complex thinking and they water it down so much the students are basically doing very rote things. And I feel like on a school level, the more a staff can have that vibe where there are simple core values and there are things that are part of the core that are non-negotiable but that people have bought into, then from that stems a lot of really complex personalized things that respond to the people who you have.
So okay. If I can also...
Okay. Go ahead.
So I feel like something that maybe captures what people are saying as a whole, and what struck me about the video as well, is this idea of ignoring a few basic axioms. And I think there's something, that idea stops short, because I think where Einstein may have ignored a few basic axioms, he also created a few basic axioms. And I think in creating your school, it's important to be selective about which axioms you're going to ignore. But what everybody is speaking to as well is what axioms they actually came around and replaced them with. There are a few, and I know at High Tech High, I haven't been at High Tech High in years, but I still feel like I'm quite familiar with their few basic axioms. And I just feel like it's important to make sure that point is made, that we can ignore these few basic axioms, but there are these things, these we wants, we haves, the core values that every school uses to identify itself. And those are important, whatever they are and wherever you get them from.
Okay, so...
Yeah,
go ahead, Dan. Sorry.
This is Sam.
Oh, Sam.
Yep. Hey, everybody. Just to build on that in terms of... I think the one piece I wanted to emphasize, and hopefully this back around, this ties the whole video and this conversation back around to this question of your school narrative. I think there's a narrative, there's a written and spoken narrative, which is something I invest a lot in. You know, that's why I like to write and speak about education. But then there's also the narrative that's told by your actions. And I think about the first thing you said in the video, Larry, about what you put in and then what you don't allow in. And you used the example about the bathrooms or the PA system. And I think that when you think about some things like that, that's actually part of creating the narrative, because it's what people inevitably talk about, whether you ever talk about it or not. A school without a PA system sends a message, right? And so there's the actual practical result of not having a PA system, which is a lot less interruptions during class and so on. But then there's also the signal that that sends both to everyone who works at the school, everyone who attends the school, everyone who hears about the school. And it's so I think in selecting some actions like that about whether it's those axioms that you're going to accept and live by or those pieces that you keep out, I think that that in and of itself is a crafting of your narrative and the narrative that will be told about the work that you're doing.
That's a very good point. I want to ask you, since you've worked with incarcerated and post-incarcerated youth in Providence, Rhode Island, what was the narrative of that institution, if you want to provide it to us, Sam? What would you say it was in its distilled sense?
Of the prison itself?
No, I mean I'm talking about the street place where people came.
Oh, okay. So I ran a youth program for an organization in Providence called AS220. It's an arts organization that's been around for 28 years, and we were working with young people who were incarcerated or in group homes or foster care. And so particularly around the prison work, because that's what Larry initially asked, the narrative was about creating a seamless transition for young people coming out of prison, and the way that we did that was through arts and entrepreneurship. And so we had a lot of young people with a lot of creative energy and talent. We had a lot of young people with a lot of entrepreneurial spirit. In some cases, that entrepreneurial spirit had been used in a ill or extra legal context. And so we were all about basically taking all of that energy and providing a positive outlet for it. So, you know, we like to think of ourselves as the coolest gang in town. And what we meant by that was we're taking a lot of the great things that young people need, that we know they need, around, you know, fitting in, a sense of belonging, the kind of culture that Nikki was talking about, you know, safety and community and a way to get the resources that one needs. But then we were doing that in the context of creation and production, as Larry talked about in the video, rather than in a context of violence or destruction. So I hope that answers your question, Larry.
That's a great one. Judith, I have something for you, Judith, if I may.
Before you pose something to me, can I pick up on something that went by a minute ago? And that is people resonating with the idea of what you don't let in. And much of this course is set up around developing a narrative, thinking about what you want for a school. And so I don't know if this is pushing too far toward imagining what it will be like to live a first year in this school. But it seems to me that the choices about what you don't let in, what you let in and what you don't let in, partly get thought through at the beginning, so you don't have the segregated bathrooms, you don't have the PA system. But a lot of what I see happening, for example, in the high-tech high schools when I visited and when I've talked to you, Larry, about issues that come up is on a day-by-day basis, what may seem like small decisions have big consequences. Mm-hmm. So the living out the what you don't let in. And I wonder if you could just address that for a moment, because as people think through the puzzle pieces for the school, I mean, part of it is imagining living with the commitments that you make.
Well, I'll just say a quick thing about that. One of the interesting things about letting some things in, which is why I put that at the front of this video, is that there are a lot of things that once you let them in, they're a lot tougher to get rid of once you've got them in. So you want to think them through before you even start with them. It took people a long time before they even realized that we didn't have a PA system. But if you've lived without one, it's great. When I was in another district and I wanted to get rid of the PA system, people looked at me like, you know, I was a monster because I wanted to get rid of the PA system. So you do need to give that a lot of thought. Judith, here's a question I wanted to ask you about this. We're now seeing universities, and you work at one of the largest universities in the world, public universities, and you're involved in a school, right? That's a school that's in Berkeley, not
yeah. We have our own charter school.
I just want, just very briefly, because I want to share the air. What is the narrative for you as a dean of an ed school like that, convincing other people in your organization, assuming you needed to, of why it might be a good idea for you to have a relationship in a K-12 directly that's proximate to your institution.
Oh, well, that was that's an interesting story because, as you might imagine, and we weren't the only ones. I should say that the Graduate School of Education was a partner with other folks on campus in thinking that one of the ways that we send a signal at Berkeley about a value we care about deeply, 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 which is access to the this very high-quality public education. The one way we send a message about that is to invest ourselves in the K-12 schools. And that's something that happens at the university level, not just the School of Education. And it's got a long history. So that said, when the idea was put forward that we should put our money where our mouth is in more than just the outreach programs we do and have a charter school, many people said, we don't know anything about actually running schools. What are we talking about? But we partnered with a good organization. We partnered with Aspire. And it's now been a decade of partnership, and the school has been thriving. And they had their first, started as a 612, so they had their first graduating class, I think it was 2 years ago. And all of the students in the graduating class were accepted at four-year colleges and universities, and we now have several CalPrep students at Berkeley, even though we make no promises about accepting the graduates here. So the message is the same as the Berkeley message overall, which is this combination of access and excellence. So that's been the driving narrative.
Okay, and Dan, hey Dan, so now that you're doing the work that you're doing with Chris Rogers at Tufts, which I would just characterize quickly as being somewhat involved in the makers movement and having kids be creating things, you're trying to drive a narrative about that into existing schools. I'm guessing that when you're doing such driving into existing schools, you're going into a couple few classrooms, not the entire school. A lot of us have experienced that, and I know that there are some questions that we're going to be answering from the listeners here today about that question about starting small within it. What's your take thus far about the benefit and detriment of having a little cabal within a school?
I think it depends on what the core values of this school are. So one thing that I heard recently from a principal at Expeditionary Learning who was quoting someone else says, if you want to know what people value, look at their pocketbook and their day planner. So I think that the schools that we work with, there are varying levels of buy-in in terms of what they allow the kids to do. So one thing that we stress with engineering is that it really is an iterative process that, you know, even though kids may come up with a neat first idea, that it really takes craftsmanship. And I think that some schools allow space for that and others don't. So I think that when you're working with the school and when you're thinking about your own school, so much of the scheduling affects what you value. Like thinking even the schools that partner with us, I mean, we love them. We'll, you know, we like working with kids. We like getting the message out. But thinking about the environments that we go into and what the assumptions about among the students and the staff are about, you know, what learning looks like, what engineering is, and sort of what the role of the teacher is. So our argument is that teachers are creative professionals and that they really drive the learning and that the students are doing diverse creative tasks. So at some schools, that's a no-brainer, and that's part of the core of the place. And at other ones, we're somewhat pushing against the culture. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's at least something you can
That very, very much does. Okay, before we go to answer some of the questions from our audience. We're halfway through tonight's class. Is there anything that anyone else would like to add before we jump in? Nikki looks like she's ready.
I think in starting a couple of new schools for High Tech High, one of the things that really brought the adults together was doing an activity we call a significant learning activity, where we think back to our high school years and we think about a time, it didn't have to be in school, where we felt that we had a very significant learning experience. And then we break down together what were the qualities of that learning experience. And in that process, almost always we find some similar qualities. We find that there is a real world connection to the learning. We find that there are relationships that really matter. Often that people are working, that in that learning we were working with people who were passionate about whatever it was. And often that there was an end game, that there was an end experience, whether it was an exhibition or a final goal that we were reaching, that was really important as well. And that together, once we did that as adults, we were able to come together with a narrative that actually very much matched the design principles of High Tech High.
Okay, that's terrific. Thank you. So I have one extra comment to make, but I realized just now that it morphs quite well into the top-ranked question that was sent in. And the top-ranked question that was sent in, it does not surprise me, came from someone named Kay in San Diego. I expect more of the same as the weeks go on. And that question is, how do you make your narrative simple, compelling, and direct without it seeming like the latest education jargon strung together? You know, this comes back to a point that Judith made about Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot's reading. The reason that I've always had that in the syllabus of the course when I taught it face-to-face was that when Sarah talks about two things, one of them was when she was a young girl, she had an aunt, and her aunt took very quick pictures of her in the dappled sunlight and gave them pictures and gave her pictures and gave her pictures. And then when she became a very famous professor, she went and stood for a very studied oil painting where she had to stand there on Thursdays for a couple hours for months and didn't get to see it until it was finished. Those are, and the point being that a very measured, studied development and a very quick, easy taste of a development are equally valuable when you're creating a school. So that would be my answer to this question. I think it needs to be more complicated in terms of standing for the oil painting. When you're writing your proposal to your authorizer or your funder, that's the way it is. Somebody asked a great question. Do you need to use the kind of language that they want to hear? Yes, you do. And then you need a shorter one that's basically your language, that's your quick take. Dan, are you ready to say something? You look like you're ready to jump.
I was probably just being fidgety. The one thing that I did think of is that I've been speaking with someone who's opening a school in Somerville, Massachusetts, and he had exactly what you just mentioned, which is he had a very short slide deck that he can give to people who are being introduced to the school for the first time. And then he had, a 200-page innovation plan. So sort of piggyback on what you're saying, I think there are multiple levels with which you both formally and informally pitch the school, and some of those will feel jargony, but you want to have the short version ready in various forms at various times.
And by the way, that slide deck by Alex Resnick and with Sprouts is one of the best slide decks I've ever seen that anyone put together to propose a school. So I've revealed his name to all of you. So there
yes.
You go.
Alec Resnick, Somerville STEAM Academy. It's good stuff.
Terrific, terrific, terrific school he's got going. Okay, anyone else going to comment on that question? Or if not, seeing no hands, I will move on to the next one. Many schools openly discuss the need for change, but have a hard time doing it. What are the prerequisites for change, and can narratives be used to influence the evolution of existing schools? This is from Tom in New Hampshire. I have a bit to say. Anyone else want to jump in? Yes, go ahead, Nikki.
I think one of the things that's key for change is that we have a small school that where all the adults come together often and connect and reflect about how we're doing. We look at student work often through exhibitions and other morning meetings or professional development meetings. So we have a lot of community time together where we are reflecting on the work, sometimes just as adults, but often we're including students in that conversation, and we ask ourselves, what strikes us about this? What do we think we could adjust? And we're comfortable. In the video it said, hard on the content, soft on the people. That's a constant for us.
Okay, and I have, thank you for that, and I have a few Tom and everybody from my own experience back east in a very older established school. And these were created with Rob Reardon, my long-term colleague, and Adria Steinberg, my long-term colleague, who, by the way, Sam is smiling because that happens to be his mother. Sam didn't pop out this smart by accident, you know. So one thing that we did, Tom, was we knew that we needed a narrative because we've got tenure and everybody's there and some people don't like it and they're not going anywhere and that's the way it's going to be. And so the narrative that we developed was that there's something that some of us are going to try to do and nobody is going to be made to do it who doesn't want to do it. The second piece to that was, however, no one who doesn't want to do it is going to be allowed to keep those of us who do want to do it from doing it. You get the point? No threat to anyone. Those who are on board are on board. And that way, we sort of began to carve out a space to work with. That was step one. And we actually called it the Center for Integrated Studies. It was the size of a closet. And I think that High Tech High actually derives from the Center for Integrated Studies that was opened in a closet in 1990. This took a while. And the other idea is something I learned from someone named Susan Strauss, who worked with us, about that when you're trying to develop a narrative and you're trying to work with a group of people like the faculty, don't call them the faculty. They are not a blob. That everybody is comprised of different complex sets of motivators. And what you do is you go out and you say, okay, Bill, you're going to go and you're going to work with Dan and you're going to go talk to them. And Jane, you're going to see Nikki, you know, at soccer. And then, John, you're going to be playing chess next week with Judith. And then you're going to catch up with Sam, and that's how you do it. Very high touch, one-on-one, is the way to get going. It's a little bit like community organizing 101. Anyone else?
Yeah. Hey, Larry.
Yes.
It's Judith. All right. So I have two thoughts here. One, it picks up a little bit on what Nikki was saying, is you know, it'd be easy to see that question about changing existing schools as being just in a different universe from let's start new schools. And everybody knows, and Larry, you and I have talked about this a lot, the uphill challenges of trying to change existing cultures and structures. But the fact of the matter is, I suppose this is similar to the comment I made before about living with the commitments you make. Once you're open and running, you are in that question about how... Right? That's where you are, is figuring out when and how to change a school that has been launched, that's underway. So you got to have a way to cope with that, because being humans, we love our routines. And we, you know, we live by habit. So that's one thing. I'm also a bit of a slow tracker here in terms of the dialogue about the question. So I want to go back to the first question just for a second about how you make the narrative simple, compelling, and direct. And I think the test of that is trying it out. I mean, you end up simplifying it, making it more compelling, making it more direct by seeing who it resonates with. So one of the things that we can practice with in this course is exactly that.
Right. Very good. I'm going to move on to the next question, because we have enough to carry us over the next 20 minutes that are certainly worth answering. And thank you all for these questions.
Larry.
Yep.
Sorry, can I say one thing about that last one?
Of course.
I have a lot to say about it, but the one thing I want to just make sure to slip in before we move on is just, I think when the question was about prerequisites for change, and I think one thing to be really, that we should be really careful about is punishing failure, right? Because inevitably when you're changing or when you're innovating, some things are not going to work. And if we have a culture in a school where anytime something doesn't work, either we directly or inadvertently end up really punishing people for that, it really creates a culture where it's hard to be a part of trying to change anything. So I just think that's a piece, it's the kind of, in some sense, the ugly side of it, but I think it's an important piece to address if we're serious about wanting to cultivate a culture of change.
And I've got a few taglines that I use in that regard, Sam. One of them I got from someone else, which is, there's no innovation without failure. And so just relax, you're going to make mistakes. There's no way that you're innovating without making mistakes. And then when you do make a mistake in a setting that sometimes they say, well, that really didn't work, who's one of your critics, and then say, compared to what? You know, what's already not working, so don't get too defensive. And I think it's good to keep it light and kind of joke around with people about these things. Okay, so Katerina from the Netherlands, who is conceivable to me is, it's the crack of dawn right now for her. Good morning. What is the single most important piece that you should have to start a school? I want everyone to consider that for a moment, and I'm going to jump in with the following. Unless you're doing one online like us, my answer is a building. You really need a place for it to be. And maybe it's the carpentry teacher in me, but I do think that getting a facility is going to be the thing that you really need to be thinking about. You're just flat out not going to have a place that kids can come to without. And I think that you should think about a few things when you're looking for a facility. The most important thing is that you're looking for a facility where the architecture does not get in the way. You don't want to be trying to do what you're doing despite the architecture. I like big old warehouses myself because the iconic elements of some of our schools here, which are old warehouses, are height, light, and structure. Having big tall ceilings and having lots of natural light come in really just make the place feel warm and great, just like an artist studio, great for showing student work. And also by structure, I mean, of course it has a structure to hold it up, but I mean that like children's museums today, the structure is revealed, the bones of the building are revealed, so the students see how the building works. Would anyone else like to talk about what they think is a really important piece for starting to help Katerina?
I would like to. I also think connected to that building piece is a location that is in the community that you wish to serve, because you obviously need students for your school. And so identifying the community that you wish to serve, and then that location is really important. For us, the location needed to be next to public transportation because that was important to the community that we needed to serve. And it needed to be central to some urban connections within our community. So,
okay, great. Dan?
I was just going to say, to me, it's the people. Going back somewhat to Judith's point, there are many different sort of pedagogical approaches you could take to your school, but you're ultimately trusting, you know, other people's children to the adults in the building. And just whoever they are, like, I just feel like whatever school I've been in, it's really the people, sometimes even more so than the vision, that really drives the place. Where, you know, and even their flexibility, like if you have a school that has a flexible structure that is open to personalization, you want to know that that's in the right hands and that the people who, you know, adults are trusting their children with are ones you stand behind.
Yes. Okay, very good. I'm going to go on. Yes, Feroz.
Yeah, I just want to add one more thing about people. I think something about people that's really important in starting a school is, depending on whether you start with one or two grades, unless you're starting with a full school, which I doubt anybody will do, who you pick becomes really important because you start to double and triple in size very quickly as a school. And so when Nikki talks about forming a culture early and keeping that culture early, that it's that core group of teachers, that first year group of teachers who are going to be attracted to this just from their own sort of entrepreneurial spirit. And they're all going to be potentially, and I've seen this happen in some startups, they all have their own vision for a school, and they all want to create the school in their own vision. But in the way that Nikki described having everybody on the same page early, I think that's a critical, critical piece as your school doubles in its second year, begins to triple in its third year. Next thing you know, this small group of, I remember in a couple small startups, we started out with 8 people sitting around a table where our staff meetings, and before we blinked, there were 30 of us and 450 kids. And so having a core group, having that common intellectual mission figured out early, I think is really important to prepare yourself for when you double and triple. And I think it also goes back to that question about change and how you protect yourself from change or from actually regression to the mean.
Yes, great. Thank you, Fro. So I'm going to go on to the next one and seeing no hands. Great. Okay. This is a really good one from Dan L. in Philadelphia. Thanks for sending this, Dan. Is there a preferred order of operations for narrative mission statement development along with board construction, parens if you need to construct a board. How do you balance input with retaining control of the vision? I'm going to take my first jump at that, if that's all right, and that is that I do think that you want a narrow mission in the very beginning. Don't overload it early. It's going to get way too complicated. And don't, someone else asked a question about whether you first have the staff and they do the vision, or you have the vision and then you do the staff. The vision evolves. You can have an early vision by yourself. It could be modified when you bring along other people. Regarding boards, I wanted to just say my own thoughts about boards. I think that a lot of startups make a mistake by having a lot of boards, like board members, like 19, 25, 29 people. Remember, you have to manage up and you have to manage down. And you're going to be very busy managing everything else without having that many people on your board. I personally think 5 is a good number, and that's probably on the low end for a lot of people. I also think that you want people, pick them very carefully, because you're going to be living with them. And so make sure that they are people that really will help you, in particular in areas that you might need help, like finance. I think a lot of boards expect you to be the educator and that you need less educators on your board and more people who have specialties like on facilities and finance, the kind of things that you need to learn from them on. Would anybody else like to say something about this preferred order of operations narrative mission? And seeing
hey,
none. Yes, go ahead.
Larry. Yeah. I'm curious from your experience about the whether the composition of the board, whether it's helpful to think about changing composition of the board given certain things you may particularly value for board members when you're trying to get launched, get resources, get facilities, handle the legal stuff, all of that, versus a board going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think, you know, first of all, for those of you who are not in the United States right now, I'm very sensitive to that, and I'll use some language about the United States, which is that you're creating a corporation that's a 501c3, a public benefit corporation. So it is a corporate entity, and there are a lot of laws that you do have to be keen to in doing so. Even though you're a non-for-profit entity. And I think that, for me, what I want from board members are people who I'm expecting to actually, to answer Judith's question, there might be more churning in the board in the early going, where some people just stay for a while, and that's really okay. Though I really hope to have, and I'm fortunate to have, a couple few key board members who've actually even been with us from the beginning now, 13 years in. They understand our history. They've understood the hiccups or the ups and the downs, and they're just extremely supportive people who are very, very smart, help us when we've got a puzzle on our hands, don't micromanage, are not top-down. Those are types of people that you really want. You want people that are there for you when you need them, and they want you to not need them too much, right? You've got to have some independence. I think that's the blend that I would look for. That would be my answer to Dan's question. Okay, next I'm going to go to another question, which is it's from HGH MOOCs. That sounds like a suspicious... That's Patrick, our man behind the scenes who makes all of the magic happen. Do you need to know people with a lot of money to be able to start a school? If so, how do you meet them? Well, not at racetracks and betting parlors. I think that you don't net, a lot of people start schools without a lot of money. It depends on the environment that you're in. I mean, if you go to the East Coast of the United States, for those of you from other countries, but and internally here, the per pupil expenditure, or ADA, average daily attendance money, is typically much higher, 12, 13, 14, even 17,000. It tends to be lower in some of the poor states, 4,000, 7,000 in the case that we have in California. What you need to do is have, what you really need to do, what you absolutely need to do is you need a really good chief financial officer. We've got a great one. We're very fortunate ourselves because that person really, you have to run the books. And there's just no two ways about it. So if you are a student, it's not about throwing money at the problem. The problem that you're going to have is that you're going to need a facility, and that is very specific to whether you are in an area, and there are many of them, where the district supplies a facility for you, or whether you're going to be going it alone. If you're going to be going it alone, you're going to be using some public bond financing mechanisms that we have in the United States and other scenarios for other countries. That would be my take on that one. I hope it doesn't need a lot of money, because a lot of people that are doing it, it's easier if you have it, but a lot of people are doing it without it. Anyone else? All right.
Larry, yes. I have a question for you, actually. Sure. Some of the schools that I've worked in, I felt like, and this is not uniquely my observation, but the schools were being tugged in various directions based on the will of their funders. Mm-hmm. And we felt this at the classroom level. Mm-hmm. And it's actually one of the questions I think that propelled me into grad school. But I wonder how do you insulate even the classroom from those forces that are just so far away but seem to get somehow through that special membrane of the classroom door?
Great question. And my answer to that, Feroz, is you don't accept, as the leader of the school, you don't accept money which directs you off mission, even though you need money. If you're going to do that, you're making a compromise that you need to protect the teachers from. And so you got to cut it off in the first place. If you're taking money that's going to have you do something that's pedagogically really opposite to your mission, then you should stop taking it, is my answer. That's, you don't really, what you don't, I don't think you're suggesting this. I don't think what you want to do is tell the funder you're going to do X and then in reality do Y, you know? So basically say, well, you say to the funder, we really want money for Y. And they say, well, we don't fund Y. Find another funder. And say, well, would you be interested in X? Well, they might be interested in X. Let me see if you modify this, you might decide to do that. But basically, pretty much, that's the person who's bringing the money in the first place. And I don't think it is the fundraiser in a school that brings in the money. I think it's primarily the head of the school that brings in the money, because that is the person that is the primary carrier of the narrative of the school, in my view. Anyone else? Okay. Yeah, Nick, is that Nikki?
I think this speaks a little bit connected to your order of operations question, I think, from Dan previously, is this idea of having a leader that really knows who they are and builds a solid staff cohort that also knows who they are and they understand the mission of the school. I think in starting a brand new school, with you want to have a few strong teacher leaders who are going to hold tight to a mission or a core. And then I also think it's really helpful to have those few people be involved in the hiring of the rest of the team. I think that helps a lot in building, again, the culture that will support the core through the years.
Great. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Nick. And now I've got one from Aja in Chicago. A really good question. What role does the narrative play in a charter proposal? In considering authorizers as an audience, to what extent do they want to see narrative versus others which might consider a more traditional writing style to proposals? Okay? And this is going to be one of our last questions. And that is, when you were writing, this is the last question actually, when you were writing for an authorizer and there are elements to your charter, look at what successful charter proposals have gone through the eye of the needle of your authorizer. I do not urge creative writing. I don't urge deceitful writing, but not creative writing in your authorization. If there are things that your authorizer needs to see in each of the elements, they better see those things in each of the elements and make sure, and it's your job to put them in there, and it's your job, and it doesn't have to be in the charter application per se, to be able to crosswalk that for multiple and diverse audiences. And that's what the purpose of this very course is, developing a narrative for multiple and diverse audiences so you can crosswalk yourself as a leader between what you put in the charter, which meets the authorizer's requirements, and what you really believe in, which is your narrative. Okay, not that they're contrary, but they can't be written in exactly the same way. They are indeed. One of them is descriptive writing, and one of them is persuasive writing. And there are differences between a descriptive voice and a persuasive voice. And the descriptive voice is what you need in the authorization, and a persuasive voice is what you need in your narrative. So we are going to wrap it up, but I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, check the newsletter in your inbox, which will come at 9 a.m. on Sunday morning. Next week's topic is going to be about purpose, the purpose of the school, which is certainly a very important piece for all of us. We're going to have several other guests with us next week. We're going to have Ann Warrell, who runs one of a great little elementary school, and Melissa Daniels, a middle school person, and Kelly Wilson from a graduate school. Maria Heredia, an attorney who knows a lot about authorization, for those of you who might want to pump in some questions about that. And, of course, Jeff Robin. If you want to get a taste of what he's like, go to Jeff Robin, JeffRobin.com. You won't regret it, and you'll never forget it. So, and I want to thank everybody. Thank you, Dan Wise, so much, in from the cold, coming out to southern sunny California, and Nikki Hinostro, always wonderful. For Rose Munchie, great to see you again. Judith, you too. Sam, thanks for being here. And everybody, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next week, same time. Purpose is on the agenda. Bye-bye.
Bye.